kingsolomongrandlodge@fwfm.org or by calling the King Solomon Grand Lodge at 202-378-3843. A very heartfelt thank you goes out to all who contributed. We wish you a very happy holiday season and a prosperous new year. WPFW and our partners continue to positively impact the community one event at a time.
I'm Weezy Muntali, host of African Now, and you're tuned to member-supported WPFW Washington.
And thanks for tuning in to the Inside Out LGBTQ Radio Collective on WPFW 89.3 FM. My name is Lee Levinson-Perrine, and I'm excited to be on the air tonight. I'm a DC-based curator, connector, and community builder, and I'm the founder of an LGBTQ arts collective called Black in Space. I'm also known as Commander Lee of the Black in Space Star Crew. Samantha G and I are back on this fifth Monday as we celebrate fall, family, and Libra season. Before we hop into this evening's show, I want to tell you more about Inside Out. Inside Out is a collective that illuminates and celebrates the rich diversity of the LGBTQIA+ experience. This groundbreaking show has aired since 2008 and is DC's only show of its kind on the FM dial and one of only a handful in the country. We take you inside this community to look at everything from pop culture to politics through an LGBTQIA inclusive lens. We are proud to be part of the legacy of cutting-edge public affairs programming on WPFW, home of Jazz and Justice Radio. Inside Out airs every Monday at 6 p.m. on 89.3 FM and WPFWFM.org. So let's hop into tonight's show. And what I want to do first is introduce my awesome co-host, the one and only Samantha G. So I'm going to tell you about her before she gets on the mic. Samantha G is a writer, vocalist, voice actor, entertainer, and storyteller. She is also director of Sway for Black in Space, formerly known as Maker's Lab, where she is affectionately referred to as her alter ego, Captain Sam, an unfriendly ethereal lesbian from outer space. Captain Sam is a voice actor and voiceover artist. She also streams gameplay, guided meditation, IRL play dates, and ASMR. Find her on all social media platforms at SheBeSamanthaG. Welcome, Samantha G.
Hello, Commander Lee. I'm happy to be here representing for Black in Space. And for those who don't know about us at Black in Space, we are always celebrating the artistry, diversity, and resilience of the Black LGBTQ communities through media, storytelling, and technology, and so much more. And tonight we are joined by our special guests, Miranda Mims and Stephen G. Fullwood, the co-founders of Nomadic Archivist Project. So Nomadic Archivist Project, or NAP, is an initiative that documents and preserves the global Black experience. And I'm really excited to be talking to them today, Lee.
Sweet. So, Sam, before we bring on these two amazing guests who I'm so excited to talk to, can you tell me what's been bringing you joy today, weekend? Yeah. All the things.
Well, no, you know, every day Libra season brings me so much joy. And I know everyone thinks that they are excited about fall. You are not excited about fall. You are excited about the onset of Libra season. You know, the real lovers, the real yearners, the true diplomats, and the real friends. They are all coming out of the oven today, or defrosting, if you will.
Thank you for that, Samantha. And speaking of friends and family and just really dope folks, we have our guests Miranda Mims and Stephen G. Fullwood. So Stephen and Miranda, welcome.
Hi.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for inviting us. We appreciate it.
No, thank you. Thank you for being here. I've been a fan of y'all's work for years. And so before we get into the official work of what NAP does, can each of you tell me what's been bringing you joy, if it's a music, video, moment, all the things?
Well, for me, talking to Black folks who love Black folks and advocate for Black folks the way I do, that brings me joy.
Nice.
I think most recently, since I'll keep it a little bit more personal, I went to homecoming. For the first time, I went back to my undergraduate university, Binghamton University, in 20 years. And the reason why I went back was because I met my partner there 20 years ago. And so it was nice to be able to go back together and share in that experience.
Nice. Sweet. What's your school mascot? What is Binghamton?
The Bearcats.
Oh, okay. All right. There's go Bearcats.
Meow.
Thank you for sharing. I'm now going to turn it over to Samantha G, who's going to tell folks more about Nomadic Archivist Project before we hop into some questions. So Samantha, want to take it away?
Yeah, surely. And I'm really excited to be meeting the two of you. I'm really thrilled to hear more about this project. The Nomadic Archivist Project, or NAP, N-A-P, is an initiative that partners with organizations, institutions, and individuals to establish, preserve, and enhance collections that explore the global Black experience. Their central objective is to archive local histories from a grassroots perspective. NAP does not subscribe to the philosophy that curation and archiving should stem from the mission of traditional repositories. They believe in flexibility and the freedom to choose the path to archiving one's creative endeavors, political advocacy, family, and history. NAP believes in equitable partnerships that arise from the needs of the community. They are dedicated to developing archival literacy in audiences unfamiliar with the process of identifying, collecting, and preserving cultural heritage. Miranda and Stephen, now that was a mouthful, right? For those of us who don't use the word archiving every day and curation every day. So we really can't wait to learn more about your work. So can we just start by telling people what in the world archiving is? I know some of us have collections of bottle caps or, you know, stamps that we don't check on, but what is actual archiving? What does it entail?
So Miranda and I are pointing at each other right now, because I think that Miranda has really great ideas about archiving. But I'll start out by saying that archiving is collecting memory, narrative. It is collecting objects, both physical, digital. It is the idea that you are connecting with not only your own experience, but the experiences of people from the past, but also you are anticipating a future, right? So what I like to tell people is that when you archive yourself, when you start to collect and preserve your history, your cultural history, you deserve the benefit of your own experience, your family's experience, your professional, personal experience, your artistic experience, your community's experience. So archiving in that sort of theoretical sense, but also in a very practical sense, helps us live a fuller life, I believe.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I would definitely share in everything that Stephen just said. And you know, the way that I sort of think about archives, I used to actually think about archives as something of the past, like a space that you would go to find historical documents or artifacts, something that could tell a story about the lived experience of someone else or another culture before your time. But I now think about it, archives, as something that is present, and even more something that is future forward, something that Stephen just sort of touched on, and really thinking about like the things that we're doing now, the things that we're preserving and saving now, speaking to people into the future. And why, sort of what Stephen was saying, you know, why the things that we're holding on to today are really important and meaningful, because they will somehow, some way, if it's not from like an archivist or somebody who's, you know, archivally minded, will be saving these things and passing it on through the generations.
Mm-hmm. You know, I like how you all both emphasize the future, because when, like you said, when we think about archives, we do think about the past. And, you know, with Black in Space, as we center Afrofuturistic themes, I've always said that the Afrofuturistic thought or Afrofuturist theory or whatever you want to call it, is the concept that Black people do exist. We have existed, but we will continue to exist. And you cannot conceptualize a future until you have settled with the now and until you've interrogated the past. And I can imagine that archiving is one of the key ways that we interrogate the past, through the actual artifacts of that time. So that's really, really important work that you all are doing. And tell us a bit about your backgrounds. And, you know, I'll say someone go first so that you all don't have to thumb wrestle for it. So, Miranda, tell me a bit about your background and how you became an archivist.
Okay. I sort of have a little bit of a wayward background, which I think a lot of archivists do. But I was sort of trained, I always think I was trained by my mother, who's a genealogist. Mm. And so from a very, very young age, I spent a lot of time in, you know, different court archives or, you know, church archives or, you know, even cemeteries, you know, trying to dig up the past and dig for, you know, my ancestors. And so for a long time, you know, my mind was sort of thinking about these things in terms of family and how the archives would tell me something about the people that I came from. But then I started to, you know, as I grew up and started to study, I have a degree in Black studies and African studies. And I had no idea what I was going to do with those degrees. And then I found, you know, the Library of Congress in the African Middle Eastern Reading Room. And I started to work there and intern there. And that gave me a completely different perspective too on how to actually maintain and preserve, these amazing objects. And then from there, I got a degree in archives and started working at the Schomburg Center with Stephen. And we worked together for about 7 or 8 years before I moved on to the University of Rochester for another 7 years.
I see. What I love about Miranda's story, I always want her to say, yes, she, even as a baby, her mother was carrying her around while she was doing this genealogical work. And so she was sort of born into this. And for me, it was more of a search for family and identity. I think that's how I got interested in history and culture and eventually archives. I went to school for broadcasting and English, but soon found out that I was not suited for a newsroom, a broadcasting newsroom in any manner, shape, or form. I fell in love with the library as a kid, spent a lot of time there, became a children's librarian for 3 years. In Toledo, Ohio, my branch library, shout out to you guys, and ended up going to school for at Clark Atlanta University for management. I really wanted to manage an institution like the Schomburg Center. Moved to New York City, was hired in February of 98, and was really trained well at the Schomburg Center, not just in the technical aspects of being an archivist, but the political and cultural responsibilities of being an archivist through Howard Dotson, who took my resume to Diana LaChatelier, both former employees at the Schomburg Center, and I couldn't have had a better experience. So for about 19 years, 3 months and 24 days, I bathed in Black history every day, essentially, right? And not just Black American history, but Caribbean history, Afro-diasporic histories, African histories. And I could, like I said, I couldn't have had a better experience. I met Miranda in 2010 when she became an archivist there. So that's how I became an archivist. And it just dovetails with everything I love doing. I love writing books, editing books, and creating. So it all makes sense to me.
Nice. Thank you for sharing your stories. Just real quick, I'm going to do a station ID. You're listening to WPFW Washington, and we're joined by our special guest today, Miranda Mims and Stephen G. Fullwood of the Nomadic Archivist Project. One of the questions that I had for y'all is, because Miranda, I met you years ago in D.C., and then when you moved to New York with the Schomburg, that's how I had an opportunity to meet Stephen. And now you all are in this very like special chapter of your archiving careers with Nomadic Archivist Project. And so just wondering, when and why did you launch this project? And I'm also very interested in names, right? And so why did you choose this name? So I don't know if y'all want to, how y'all want to split that. So yeah.
I can start. So Stephen at some point just got the idea that he was going to, leave and go off and do his own thing. And so, he left me at the Schomburg only for a few months, because then once Stephen left, I was like, you know what? What am I doing here without Stephen? No, you know, we had different ideas of what we might do, you know. And so I called Stephen up and we met at a coffee shop in Harlem. And I told him, I was like, look, you're not doing anything at the moment. We should start this project. I have this idea. We should do it. And Stephen, you know, immediately was like, yeah, no. This is crazy. But then, you know, like, I don't know, once the sugar hit, you know, like 15 minutes later, he was like, yeah, I'm bored. Let's do it. And so it was just, you know, the Nomadic Archivist Project was started in a Harlem cafe. I think it was like an Adam Clayton Powell Boulevard, if I'm not mistaken. And that was in 2017. And, you know, it started off real fledgling. We just knew that we were interested in connecting with people. And it, you know, in this has no reflection on the Schomburg Center, because it's a brilliant space. And we were both really lucky to have been able to hold offices there. But we really wanted to explore what it would be like to have relationships and talk to people about archiving their legacies without an institution dictating what we could and couldn't say, or what we could and couldn't do. And that's for so many different reasons and a lot of practical reasons. And, you know, we just wanted a space too that we could support the work of other archivists and be, you know, be along for their journeys, especially, you know, those who are just starting off in their career, or in other independent archivists. And so, you know, we just thought about different things like a scholarship program, different things that we could do in the early years as sort of a fledgling project.
Wow. You know, I know that Lee and I have a ton more questions for the two of you, but I want to give our listeners an opportunity to call in and ask you all some questions. So if you're listening in and this is sounding interesting to you, or you've never heard of archiving and you want to know what the heck these two people are talking about, you can give us a call at 202-588-0893. And I'm sure Miranda and Stephen will be happy to answer any questions that you have about the Nomadic Archival Project. And then, of course, any questions that you have for Lee or I about Black in Space and how you can connect. We are always telling queer stories, queer Black stories in particular. And what better way to tell your story than to look back and talk about the history of your family, or the history of families of your family? And what better way to talk about how you're going to live than to think about how you're going to reach the future? We are here to make sure that Black people survive the now so that we can get to the Black future. And that is how we are supporting Black futures every day at Black in Space. So back to you, Stephen and Miranda. Yes, Stephen and Miranda, I want to talk to you a bit about your intentions when you are, you know, maybe collecting pieces. Like, are there actual artifacts part of your project? Is it all written work? Is it all recorded work? But what are the intentions that you have when you're touching things, right? I'm like a kid sometimes. When I go to the museum, I want to put my hands on things. So has there been a time when you're, holding something that's from a time or from a place and you're able to touch it, or you've wanted to touch it, and what were the intentions that you were setting when you're picking up that piece of history, you know, when you put your hands on it or put your eyes on it?
To give it some context, Samantha, I want to say that the Nomadic Archivist Project, we consult with people. So we don't have an archive per se, like a brick and mortar or digital space in the sense, in the traditional sense of what an archive is. We help people build their archives, and we help them build them whether or not they want to keep their archives or interface with a traditional institution where they would like their archives stored and preserved there. And so, but the other question you have, I think, is interesting about this idea of holding history. I think for those of you who are listening, as well as us, we are archiving a conversation right now. We are always in the process of holding an instrument like a phone or on a computer where we are archiving an experience, right? So what's exciting about touching history, it feels like our definitions of history or historical documents are becoming a lot more, they're broadening. So they include digital and less ephemeral kinds of things, or ephemeral kinds of things. And so it's exciting to, for example, to have worked at the Schomburg Center and to work on the James Baldwin papers, for example, looking at his drafts, then his handwritten materials that go to type form, and then to a galley, to kind of see how the story changes, what he kept, what he didn't keep. I love those things, but I love digital life as well. I'm that Erica Badu, clever. I'm an analog boy in a digital world, but I love both. And I think what I would encourage people to do is to think more broadly about archival archives and archival inquiry and what it means.
Wow, thank you for that. Thank you.
Miranda, is there anything you wanted to add to that? Or
I mean, I think I feel like the way that we interact with anything, whatever form it is somewhat personal. And it is also being in tune with that thing, with the creator of that thing, that makes it even more profound. And I feel, you know, like when I'm with somebody's creations or their material culture, their archives, you know, whatever you want to call it, and I'm really, you know, focused on them and thinking about like how it was that they were able to do whatever it is that they were able to accomplish, I can, you know, I can feel them. I can even hear them speaking to me. I was one time in the stacks at the Schomburg, and I was moving Arthur Schomburg's materials around because, you know, I had an idea for like how I wanted to organize his boxes in the stacks. And he yelled at me. And Schomburg's been dead for like, I don't know how many years. 30, when did he die? 36? I don't know. You know, in almost 90 years, but he yelled at me and I put the boxes back. And you know, and you, I think Samantha, you talked about intention, and it was all about, you know, what are my intentions, and was I really honoring, you know, his materials and honoring that space, or was I just, you know, having an idea and moving forward with it without actually really thinking it through, in a way that was thoughtful. Right. And so I feel like when you're really in tune with whatever it is, it could be anything. It could be something that, you know, somebody in your family left for you, whether you knew them or not, and it's sitting on your desk. When you actually stop to really think about that object, it will start, I feel like it will start to connect with you in a very profound way. And then when you're with so much stuff that, you know, and so many different people who are amazing have created this stuff, it becomes very overwhelming, and it's very powerful.
It's also very encouraging because Black folks have done everything all the time, everywhere, and usually you're just the one finding out, right? And it's coming, and when we talk about community and how we understand our histories, you know, we've been told things like, you know, derisive things like, you know, you want to hide something from a Negro, put it in a book. And it's like, it's so much richer than that. Our experience is so much bigger than the way we understand Western conceptualizations of education and learning and being with one another in a very somatic sensibility. So I think, yeah, I love what Miranda said. I just feel like when you're in places like the Schomburg or just in your community, there's just so much going on. It's really about learning and understanding and listening, having a really good ear.
Stephen, thank you for saying that, because that is one of my least favorite idioms when people say that. And, you know, when you think about it, well, perhaps people aren't reading the books because they're writing them, or they're reading the books, they're not reading the books because they're not speaking to them. You know, it is a shame that that saying became so popular, and not just popular, but popular among us. You know, I hate when we believe the things that other people say about us so much so that we echo them, but the sentiment is not true. You can't hide things from us in a book. We tear literature apart when we love it, and we create some of the best literature. You know, we are some of the best storytellers, quite frankly, because we have some of the best stories to tell. And if we aren't interested in reading what you're writing, it's because, frankly, it's not good. It's not good enough for us.
How about that?
One of my questions too is, and I know you all consult with people, but also just wondering, like, about your approach and your intentionality, like, how does, like, Blackness and queerness inform your work too, right? And your approach, and like, how has that evolved?
I feel like you should talk about in the life, Stephen.
It's funny because we still haven't figured out who's going to talk first. So to answer the question about approach in terms of archiving, for me, everything is Black, so there's nothing outside of Blackness. One. Two, the In the Life project, the In the Life archive that Miranda spoke about was founded in 1999 at the Schomburg Center by me. And
well, actually, it was before that, because you started it in your home.
Oh, thank you. Sorry about that. Yes. See, she seems, I'm telling you, just interview Miranda. She knows everything. So the project that started out as the Black Gay and Lesbian Archive, that was its original name, was a project that started out in my home. And it's one of those things where Black people are collectors. A lot of folks just collect things. They collect Ebony magazines. I might be collecting the Green Book or what have you. And I was really interested in developing, as I mentioned earlier, and learning more about my queer identity. And so it's collecting books, magazines, and other kinds of ephemera. And that became the basis for what we're talking about today, the Black Gay and Lesbian Archive, which became the In the Life Archive, and was donated to the Schomburg, which is now 25 years old. It was donated in 1999, and it contains the papers of Cheryl Clark, Alexis DeVoe, materials that had already been there, like Asado Saint's papers, a Haitian activist and performer and publisher, Joseph Beam, who is the editor of the first Black Gay anthology, In the Life, and a number of other people. So it's a really large and expansive archive. And so queerness informed it in the way, because when I got to the Schomburg had already been collecting Black queer stuff, whether it was the books of Octavia Butler, Samuel Delaney, and a number of other people. And they even had, as I mentioned, some archival materials by other countries, which is a Black Gay writing collective formulated in 1986. And so I was in the right place at the right time to not only donate the stuff that I had, but also to continue building on, because I was working in the community and I knew the people. And it was coming up on like 50 years of Black queer activism, essentially. So it was really important to reach out to the Alexis DeVos and the Cheryl Clarks, because they understood the importance of having their archives preserved, their work honored in that way. And so queerness helps us understand, I think, our lives a lot better when it comes to queerness helps us see beyond the heteronormative sensibilities around what we should collect and what our stories are, right? Who did this person love? How did she love? And so those things are really critical. And so the archive today, again, it's our 25th anniversary this year, and we'll be having some kind of celebration in New York City. We'll let you guys know. But queerness helps me breathe and think better, you know, a lot like Blackness, you know, it allows me to be creative and more thoughtful about the life I live and the lives other people live. And thank goodness for pronouns. Thank goodness. And you know, people fight them all the time, but it's one of those freedom moments that we just really need to honor, you know, period.
Thank you for sharing that. Miranda, do you have thoughts about that?
I'm gonna share Stephen's thoughts. I think in terms of especially Blackness, how it informs everything that we do at the Nomadic Archivist Project, is really actually important that, you know, for a long time we were trying to figure out like how we were going to create this space and how we were going to come about it and who we would partner with and the types of projects that we would take on. And, you know, I mean, after a while, you know, Blackness is so huge, right? And we're coming from a perspective, you know, a global perspective, right? And talking to people, no matter where they show up in the world, about whatever it is that they're thinking about in terms of their legacy or archiving. And so thinking about grounding it in this idea of Blackness, can be, you know, kind of explosive because Blackness is so different depending on where you are in this country, in other countries. But it's so fascinating and so amazing to kind of try to even tackle it, to kind of even try to like maneuver in these spaces. In these very different spaces all the time. But yeah, I don't know if I answered that, Lee.
No, you did. You did.
Okay.
So real quick, I want to let folks know you're listening to Inside Out, DC's only LGBTQ radio show. I'm your guest host, Lee Levinson-Perrine, also known as Commander Lee of the Black and Space Star Crew. This evening, I'm joined by my co-host, Captain Samantha G., also of the Black and Space Star Crew, and our special guests, Miranda Mims and Stephen G. Fullwood of the Nomadic Archivist Project. And so one of the things you talked about, Miranda, is like the projects that you all take on. And so one of the things I wanted to talk about was, what are some of the projects that you all are currently working on? And Miranda, why don't you kick it off? Let's do that.
All right. Okay. So working on currently, I'll let Stephen talk about marking time. One of the projects that I'm very excited about, and maybe the listeners on this channel will be excited about, is that I've been working with the amazing tenor saxophonist, Odine Pope, who is just an incredible jazz musician out of Philly. And he's been... So I've been working with him on his archive and thinking about like jazz, especially in like the Philadelphia and the New York area. I've also been working with some Black cultural centers out of different universities in the US and working with Stephen on a project called Archiving Marking Time, which is associated with Nicole Fleetwood's amazing project, Marking Time, that Stephen can talk more about.
And so, lovely. I love that handoff. So Nicole Fleetwood's book, Archiving Marking Time, Art and Age of Mass Incarceration, was published in 2020, where it was a highly awarded book. And it basically, the book focuses on and highlights the experiences of formerly and currently incarcerated artists, as well as artists who expose the carceral system for what it is. It's a unique, powerful critique of mass incarceration, but also it highlights how artists have used what they can to express themselves. So it goes directly against the sort of penal and abusive state powers that exist. And so what Nicole has done from that book is to create an exhibition called of the same name, Marking Time. And the exhibition debuted at MoMA PS1 in 2020 during the pandemic. And in April of 2021, she asked me to, if I would like to join her and be an exhibition coordinator for the project and help her move the exhibition around the country. We've in 5 years, we've had 6 venues, and although the original exhibition basically has stayed the same, there have been local artists who we've been able to bring into the show. We have a robust programming, and we've had associated projects like Archiving Marking Time, where we work with artists and organizations associated with the project. And so that's how Miranda comes in. And we've been doing that for the last 2 years, and we have one more year with the project, which is amazing. And in 6 days, the exhibition, which is now at Two Rivers Gallery in Prince George, British Columbia, will close and will be sunsetting the exhibition. So I'm a bit sad and overwhelmed because I just came back from Prince George a few days ago. And it's such a beautiful exhibition, and it brings a lot out in people who didn't know art was being created in prison, you know? And it brings to light the abuses again, but also this profound look at how people express themselves in the face of such brutality. So that's one of the things I'm working on, which is right now with the exhibition and some of the associated programming with Marking Time. That's largely my life at this moment.
Right. And one project that you all haven't mentioned that you work closely on together is your podcast. So would you mind sharing info about that? Because I'm a big fan of that as well. So
yes, and you've been a guest on our podcast. In the Telling is our podcast, and we are about to start our fourth season. And so In the Telling is great because we get to talk to people from all over the world about their different family stories. And so our last season was based on Black genealogists, but even with them, they spoke about like a personal either family line that they were tracing or something incredible that they found out that their, you know, family members were homesteaders at one point. But the podcast really just focuses on like regular folks talking about a story, most of the time just like a singular story that they want to sort of reflect on and talk about on the show. And it's really interesting because we've talked, I don't know, I think it's been about 14 different countries in terms of the amount of guests that we've had. But there's a through line through each and through each of the stories. I mean, they're obviously very different depending on, you know, we've had guests who talked about naming structures in West Africa. Mm-hmm. But there's still like these stories that are, you know, one of our guests talked about having two grandmas in Harlem who lived together. Mm-hmm. And, you know, but they're, you know, when you listen to them, they're just, they're really amazing. They're really telling about how connected we are, even though, you know, some of these things are so different and the locations are so, you know, far. Go ahead, Stephen.
Sorry. And I would also add that family in our sense is not just biological, it's also chosen. So this is really important. And this brings our current season that we're building right now, we're talking to folks who are trans. And what's critical about this is that how we understand culturally in this particular moment where trans folks are constantly being targeted, abused, killed, and marginalized, and laws are being enacted against them. We're advocates for Black folks. And so we want to offer a platform for our trans friends, family members to come on and talk about a family story.
And, you know, having been on that podcast, I think it was on your all's podcast, maybe that was 2020. It really helped me like strengthen and like reflect on the idea of chosen family and the idea that Patience is my niece and that Samantha is my niece and really like honoring that. And so what are some of the other lessons y'all have learned about family through your work with like In the Telling?
Well, I think that through In the Telling, some of the lessons that that continue to charm me and excite me are that people hold close to, like, I'm hearing the same sort of Black family stories throughout the ages, meaning I've heard some of these stories as a kid in some version. I'm reading about these stories and James Baldwin, Toni Morrison, or Lorraine Hansberry writing. I'm hearing a lot of the, I was raised by this person, but my biological mother, she was doing this, but I was raised by this person, so I consider her my mother. And what I love about family, like, I think you get this, you have this really lovely set of moments when we were doing the podcast where I would hear people talk very lovingly, but also in complicated ways about the people who they happen to share space with, right? And so the stories weren't always joyful, but they were necessary. And so when it comes to the Black experience, we're always going, let's always talk about, you know, that's politics of respectability. Let's just continue talking about the positive things. It's like, no, it's all these things. And so that's one of the things I love about the podcast. And yeah, I'm really happy that we do it, because it's a learning experience, researching it, inviting guests, and also just putting it all together.
Well, I'm really anxious to listen. I know now that I've got 4 seasons to dig through. This is my first time learning about this podcast, and I'm ready to comb through the archives of the podcast. Miranda, you were saying.
Oh, I was going to say, you know, to answer your question, Lee, one of the things that I find so fascinating about everybody's stories, or a lot of folks' stories, is how much land is like sort of integrated or connected to everybody's experiences. Land is like a big piece to what's sort of been passed down generation to generation, like where people can constantly find their family members. Or like the land that somebody, you know, currently now is trying to get back to mm-hmm. kind of like find that family connection. And so that's like the biggest thing, you know, like we know about this, but to, you know, to kind of hear it over and over in different ways in which people are thinking about land and family is really fascinating. But yes, thank you, Samantha. I hope you do get into it and let us know what you think about it.
Oh yeah,
and maybe you'll consider being a guest. Brewing.
Perhaps okay, I would, great. Because one thing I love to do, right, is to tell my story. And I don't mean to tell my story. When I say tell my story, I don't mean talk about me and talk about what I'm doing, right? Although I think me as a person, as an individual, yeah. I perhaps am interesting, right? People might want to know what I'm doing. But what's most important to me, and what has been a core tenet of just my existence, is showing young Black queer people that there is a path to existence, right? That there are ways to be. Not that they need to be like me, but they need to know that there are many ways to be, so that they can make a choice and start crafting whatever way they're going to be. And in my experience as a millennial, I'm a Black millennial, feminine presenting lesbian born in Washington, D.C. I'm 36 years old, or I will be in a few days, right? Mm. And in my experience, I've had peers who have flat out said, I did not think I was going to live past 35 because mm-hmm. I did not see, and this comment has come from masculine presenting Black lesbians that said, I didn't think I was going to live past 30. I didn't think I was going to live past 35 because I did not see anyone that either A, looked or behaved like the kind of adult that I would want to be, mm-hmm. or looked and behaved in a way that I thought was the Black lesbian experience. And I know that seems so odd, right? But when we find that everyone that we see in a movie that depicts a life that is ours is someone who's living all the way at the margins, living at the extremes of gender presentation, living at the extremes of poverty, the extremes of crime, or they're living, you know, the extremes of wealth. They're extremely wealthy in the L word, and we don't have ideas that we exist outside of those small boxes. And I realized that existing loudly and being willing to say, this is what it was like in 1997 as, you know, as me, this is what it is like today in 2024 as me, you would be surprised how inspiring that is for a young Black person who is just coming out of the closet and wondering, will I survive high school as a young queer person? Will I survive the workplace as a young queer person, right? And so that brings me to my question. What I always think about when I think about history and archiving or anything that is then, now, future, it's always about like intergenerational connections. And mm-hmm. how is your project making opportunities for younger people to connect with older people or older people to connect with younger people? And I don't mean bringing them together. I don't necessarily mean bringing them into the same spaces, but what are those calls back and forward for us in your project? Is there something that you've been working on that you feel like calls for older people to spend more time with younger people or to spend more time telling their own stories to younger people?
So as Miranda does some thinking, I'll start by saying that I think through the Nomadic Archivist Project, a lot of things come up that relate to Black folks collecting work. And it could be within a traditional institution or independently or what have you. And the example I can give you today is that my former two bosses at the Schomburg, my former two supervisors, Mary Yearwood, who was the director of collections and services, as well as the curator of photographs and prints, and more specifically to my experience, who was my curator for 15 years, was Dinah LaChatelier, who was assistant director of collections and services and the curator of the Manuscripts, Archives, and Rare Books Division. They're both retired. And from time to time, I'll see them. I have lunch with Diana from time to time. And we talk about these issues that are still plaguing them, that still plague the profession when it comes to people of African descent as archivists. So often I'll speak with them about things like Black appraisers. Did you guys work with a lot of Black appraisers? Appraisers are people who would appraise a collection, papers, books, or what have you. And there, as I did a brief survey recently, there's so few people doing that kind of work. So I put it on a list. And then I also carry information from those elders to the younger folks right now, the archivists and the people who are doing the work right now, the Black memory workers, and they want to know what we're up to, and they want to tell everybody wants to tell each other what's going on. You know, how is the field? Is it healthy? Are there more Black archivists? Are there more Black curators? What are the barriers to getting to that? Working with students who are in school, we're working on a mentoring program that we hope to enact soon, but we do it unofficially. We talk to younger archivists and share our experiences, but also connect them with other people at other institutions that do this work. So I think that we do it directly and indirectly and are trying to move into a space where we are doing it more directly by helping folks share their stories across generations, the experiences of being Black archivists, being Black memory workers.
I'll also add to that. I mean, I think some of the things that we do like directly that gets sort of like people talking across generations are some of the community workshops that we hold. And so I feel like that's the place where just people come together from teenagers, you know, to our elders. And they bring, you know, we typically have people bring objects and, you know, and they talk about those objects. And it's really interesting, you know, obviously, depending on like where you're coming from in the world and, you know, where you fall generationally. But I feel like those are the spaces that really kind of open up for those kind of conversations.
And of course, you know, Black in Space is always providing opportunities for intergenerational connection physically, right? I think about coming of age as a young queer person. And a lot of times, the only time you got to interact with people that were older than you, it was when you were in inappropriate situations, honestly, like when you were sneaking into a club, when you were unfortunately being groomed by someone who was older than you trying to date you, right? Or when you were looking for refuge from a dangerous situation. And I think it's always important for there to be these spaces that are safe for play, right? It's safe to dance. It's safe to commune, but also it's safe to engage. There are people here who are like-minded and they are interested in seeing you thrive and seeing you succeed as well as having a good time. So, you know, if you are listening and you are a younger person, you're looking for queer community amongst your elders, right? For someone to tell you how things were and for you, for someone that you can show how things are, connect with us at Black in Space. We've got uncles and aunties and they, them siblings and family just galore for you. But we are constantly telling our stories in hopes that you will feel comfortable telling yours, even if you feel like you have to whisper. Miranda and Stephen, this has been really, really interesting for someone like me who I am a self-proclaimed auntie. I'm always digging through the relics of not just my own family history, but I'm nosy, you know, I'm nosy as hell. So I'm asking questions about people's family history as well. And so if someone like me wanted to graduate from being a standard low level, busybody, nosy person and elevate that to, okay, let me start an infant archive, where would I start? What would I do? What do I buy? Like, what do I get on Amazon? And do I need all those little clear shelves, you know, or do I have to get, like, I don't know. Do I need to get the dehydrator to keep everything from getting humid? I don't know. Forgive me.
I mean, so, you know, if you're interested in especially physical objects and saving them and preserving them, it is really actually, Samantha, you're right on target. It's good to think about where you're actually doing this, like finding a safe place. And so that safe space looks different depending on where you are in the world. So if you're in a really dry climate where water is an issue, but there's no humidity and you're trying to save things like on VHS tapes, then, you know, like the types of things that you might buy will look differently if you're like in the Northeast and it's raining all the time and you've got basements that constantly fill up and you're always fighting like mold and water. And so, you know, you kind of want to think about your space. You just want to think about like, what is my space? What do I need to do to mitigate any, you know, potential like environmental hazards that might impact the things that I'm trying to save. A lot of the times, you know, if your materials are housed with you, they're almost the most safest, right? Because you're kind of seeing them. And so if you put them in a basement or attic, if you have those things, it's kind of like out of sight, out of mind. Something could happen. It could be, you know, months, years before you actually see that something has happened to those materials. But if it's housed like with you somewhere in your space that you can monitor it, and the climate is typically suitable for you, you know, if it's really hot, you're going to put the AC on or a fan on, something to cool down that space, which will keep your materials cooler. And so, you know, you always want to just think about keeping things where you are or in a space that is climate controlled. But other than that, you know, just kind of make sure that your materials are, you know, not on the floor or, you know, there's not a lot of bugs that can get to them or, you know, just kind of be mindful of them. I mean, really, that's the, you know, there's a lot of things that you could buy. You could go down, I mean, we could give you tons of resources of things you could buy. Archival supplies are very expensive. They're not cheap. And, you know, they're not cheap for a reason. I mean, they're typically fireproof and waterproof. But, you know, like having, if you know that your materials could get wet, having them in a plastic bin might be the best place for them. But you really want to kind of think about what your intentions are for keeping these materials. Mm-hmm. Is it just for you? After you, you don't care what happens to them. Is it so you want to pass it down to somebody, or pass it to somebody? Do you think that these materials actually are telling a bigger story about the world we live in, or your world, your community, and you might want to see it in a space where other people can share in it beyond you. And so a lot of it is too, a lot of how you save your things and store your things should also somewhat be in line with like your future objectives for the things that you're saving. And you don't have to think about it all at once either, because that's kind of overwhelming. But, you know, you always just want to at first just think, is this a safe space for me to hold things that I kind of find as sacred, that I care enough about to actually keep?
Mm-hmm. I would, everything Miranda said times two, and I would also add happy early birthday, Samantha G. And I would also add that you've already started your archive. It's something that Miranda and both of you guys have already started an archive. It's really the kind of story you want to tell. So Miranda's giving you some advice about space and about supplies and just thinking that you have time to think about it is really critical, because people get overwhelmed by this idea of archives. I need to have it done now. It needs to be organized now. And it's like, no, it's an iterative process, and it can be very instructive. And again, we can send you PDFs of supplies and articles that can be really useful to you in your project. But just think about what kind of story you want to tell, and that will help build your archive.
Wow. So what you're saying is I am already my own fully functional cloud storage. So you mean 13 years, I've been working in telecom for 13 years and I have now become the cloud. I knew it would happen one day. I knew all those conspiracy theories couldn't be wrong. I finally have absorbed the cloud into my bloodstream. I love that for me. Thank you.
Samantha is the cloud. Okay. So as we're wrapping up time here, Miranda and Stephen, how can folks find you, right? Because I'm sure folks want to learn more about your work, stay in touch, learn about the End of Life celebration, the 25th celebration that's happening, some other book projects you're going to be working on in 2025. So are you on the internet? Are you on the social media? Where do we go?
Yes,
I think the best place to go is to our website and sign up for our newsletter. So nomadicartistproject.com. It's probably the best. We're going to get better at the Instagram and probably just Instagram, but we've given up on the other platforms. But the best place to find us, yeah, is definitely through the website. And then our emails are there too.
Okay, yes. Perfect. So I think we're about
a little analog.
Very analog. I appreciate that. So I think we're about to close out the show. So I wanted to thank you all, Stephen and Miranda, for being on our show today, for sharing all this like great information with us. And helping me, I would say thank you for helping me on my like journey to become an archivist. So thank you. And Samantha, you got some closing thoughts as our millennial archivist, and you know.
Yes, I want to remind our listeners how they can get in touch with us at Black in Space. We are BLKINSPACE, or you can go to blackinspace.com, but you can find us on social media as well. Remember to check out past Inside Out shows that are archived. Haha, we learned about archives today on the WPFW website. And our show comes to an end tonight as we thank our guests and our listeners and our donors. We cannot have this show without our donors. And we also...
Join some of your favorite WPFW jazz programmers as we bring in the new year with our annual day-long retrospective, celebrating the best in jazz from 2024. We'll spin a potent combo pack of our favorite jazz recordings from 2024. We'll pay homage to our jazz ancestors who transitioned in 2024, and we'll remember some of our favorite jazz performances of the year. The day starts with Herb Taylor, 5 to 8 a.m., followed by Candy Shannon, 9 to 11, Craig Williams, 11 to 2 p.m., Willa Jenkins, 2 to 5, Helen Vixens, 5 to 7, Paul Bailey, 7 to 9, and Miles Willis rounds out the day from 9 to midnight. Join us for our annual WPFW New Year's Day Jazz Special. from your station for jazz and justice.
On New Year's Day, beginning at 10 a.m., the WPFW family and the members of King Solomon Grand Lodge will distribute to those in need all of the winter gear so generously donated by our listeners. Items such as coats, hats, socks, and more for men, women, and children are available. Support for our community begins at 10 a.m. from the Lodge, 2245 Rhode Island Avenue, Northeast. Additional information at wpfwfm.org or by calling the King Solomon Grand Lodge at 202-378-3843. A very heartfelt thank